Now, before we change tack completely and start talking about aeroplanes and the weather, I just want to mention that there will be many times that you'll feel vulnerable and out of your comfort zone. Be prepared to accept being in a zone of discomfort. It's only then that you'll be making progress. The difference between this feeling of discomfort and anything that you've felt before is that this is of your choosing. You choose the discomfort. You choose what you want to think about. You choose the parts of the anxiety that you want to face. But even more importantly, you'll be equipped to deal with it. You have to challenge yourself, because overcoming your fear of flying is not easy. It's not quick. But it is possible, and the probability is that you will do it. Facing your fear is the only way to overcome it. Tell yourself that you've done well to get this far. Congratulating yourself is an important part of overcoming your fear. Part 5. Misunderstandings about flying. We have spent a long while thinking about the way we think and the way we process negative information about flying and the way we store it in our long-term memories. We've seen the influence of the media on thoughts, and we've considered some ways of restructuring and dealing with them. Now that we know what to do and how to do it, we need to know what thoughts to change. So now we're going to look into some of the misunderstandings that people have about flying and about aeroplanes and aviation in general. Let's start with some of the common myths about flying. Air pockets. As I'm sure you will know by now, there are no such things as air pockets. Certainly, there are occasions when aeroplanes bounce up and down, and because we're more sensitive to the feelings of going down rather than going up, we get the impression that an aeroplane often drops a long way during turbulence, and these sensations are often described as air pockets. In fact, though, the average height change of an aeroplane in turbulence is less than half the height of an average room. It feels worse because you're in an aeroplane. You're travelling at 600 miles an hour. Imagine the feelings that you'd get driving over bumps in the road at 600 miles an hour. Thunderstorms. Many nervous flyers tell me that they have flown through thunderstorms. Now, unless these people have been on an aeroplane which is researching thunderclouds, it is very, very unlikely that they've actually flown through a thunderstorm. An airliner is not permitted to fly through thunderstorms. We carry weather radar which shows the precise location of the storms, and we're required by law to stay at least 20 miles from the centre of them. However, this doesn't mean that the air around them will be calm, because there is quite a lot of turbulence around the area of big storm clouds. Flying in this area may be uncomfortable, but it's not the same as flying through the middle of it, which is what some nervous flyers often claim. This impression is understandable, particularly at night when lightning is visible at a considerable distance from the actual storm. And in fact, if you're in a cloud and there's lightning activity, you will imagine that it's taking place around you because the cloud spreads and reflects the light. Another common myth, which is likely to worry you, and it certainly worries many other people, is the thought of the doors being opened in flight. This is a physical impossibility, because the forces on the door when the aeroplane is airborne are so large that no one could possibly open the door against the pressure inside the cabin. Not even a madman. Some people believe that the wings could fall off. This isn't true either, because in effect the wings are made of one piece and the cabin built onto it. Some people worry about the engine stopping, but the truth is an aeroplane can fly almost normally when an engine has malfunctioned. This brings us on to the debate about whether it's safer to fly on an aircraft with four engines or on a two-engined aeroplane. There's no real answer to this question, because engine malfunctions are so infrequent that it makes no difference. The reason that a plane has a different number of engines is to do with their commercial use. People often ask me if it would be more comfortable to fly in a big or a small aeroplane. Once again, it depends upon the precise circumstances, but in reality, it makes no difference. The sensations during turbulence, for instance, are just different. No worse, no better. Many people write to me saying that they've had to take a flight over the sea, and this makes them distinctly nervous. Well, to some extent, I suppose this is understandable, but in reality, if nothing is going to happen to the aeroplane anyway, and the aeroplane doesn't know whether it's over the sea or the land, it doesn't actually make any difference one way or the other. Once again, this will be your perception of things. The danger can be no greater because you're over the sea. Suppose you were asleep and woke to believe that you were over land, but were in fact over the sea. What you think doesn't make any difference to reality. It affects how you feel. Change your thoughts and you'll change the feelings. What about flying in old aeroplanes rather than new ones? Aeroplanes are not like cars. Owners of old cars maintain them less regularly than owners of new cars, for obvious reasons. But if the law insisted that all cars were maintained according to the manufacturer's specification throughout its life, then I guess there would be fewer breakdowns on old cars. You shouldn't compare cars with planes. With aeroplanes, of course, regardless of their age, the operators are obliged to maintain the aircraft as if it were new, and after certain periods of time and use, parts of the equipment on board the aircraft have to be renewed. Personally, I wouldn't be influenced by the sorts of aeroplanes that an airline uses on its routes. Very occasionally, people describe to me that the aeroplane has missed the runway and has had to fly around until it could find the runway again. This is a great but understandably emotive description of something that to me, as a pilot, is a very simple thing to do. And that expression, until it could find the runway again, is a true statement from a fearful flyer. But that's like saying you can't find your way home because you're coming from a different direction. I don't expect you to know this, of course, because flying isn't your subject. But now that you do, clinging on to old and wrong beliefs will prevent you from overcoming your fear. The correct terminology for an aircraft abandoning its approach to land at any stage prior to touchdown is called going around. The go-around procedure is very straightforward and very simple. If the autopilot is flying the aeroplane, all the pilot has to do is press a button or operate a switch. This action will increase the power so that the aircraft can climb. At the same time, the nose of the aircraft will be lifted about 25 degrees above the level position. Once the aeroplane is climbing at a certain rate, and that's normally 2,000 feet every minute, the power from the engines is reduced again to maintain that rate. The routing that an aircraft takes after a go-around is to climb straight ahead until it's at 3,000 feet. Then it will make a turn back towards the landing runway. There are laid-down routes for aircraft to follow, but more often than not, the radar controllers will direct the pilot so that they can concentrate on flying the plane without having to think about navigating the aircraft. Sometimes when a go-around occurs because of bad weather, the aircraft will go back to the holding procedure for the runway in use. From your point of view as a passenger, of course, this will seem alarming because it's unexpected, and there will be no information from the crew until the aircraft has levelled out. Of course, the pilot could speak to you to tell you what's happening, but I'm sure that you'd prefer that he or she concentrated on flying the aeroplane rather than talking to you and the other passengers. Most airlines now ask the crew, usually the cabin crew, to speak to the passengers as soon as possible to let them know what's happening. Although a go-around is a procedure which is fairly uncommon, pilots are required to practice this manoeuvre every 6 months on their competency checks, and are also required to do this with a malfunctioning engine and in bad weather. So if and when this happens in real life, it's very much easier to do than you might expect. Here's something that I've written about in my book, Flying Without Fear. It concerns the words uncomfortable, unexpected, and unusual. Just because something is uncomfortable to you, that doesn't mean that it's dangerous. Just because something unexpected happens on your flight, that doesn't mean that it's dangerous either. And of course, anything that is unusual to you is probably normal to the pilots. And so that doesn't mean it's dangerous either. It's quite a good idea to have short statements to say to yourself for reassurance before and during the flight. Leading on from uncomfortable, unexpected, and unusual, it might be a good idea for you to prepare a statement for each of these occasions. It might be, well, this is uncomfortable, but that's not the same as dangerous. Goodness, that was unexpected, but that's not the same as dangerous. That was unusual. I've never experienced that before, but that's not the same as dangerous. Anyone who has visited our forum will be familiar with the statement that we encourage people to use when they're feeling anxious during turbulence. Turbulence is uncomfortable, but that's not the same as dangerous. Or, I may be worried about turbulence, but it's perfectly normal to the pilots. I think it would be a very good idea if you were to prepare your own short statements for the occasions that you are anxious about, either when preparing for a flight or when you're actually on a flight. Now, it's just not possible for me to explain everything that every fearful flyer may have concerns about. The purpose of this course is to prepare you and inform you sufficiently well so that you will be able to answer your own questions. And if you work on the principle that it's very unlikely that you'll think of something that hasn't already been thought about, then you're going in the right direction. Remember too that everything in aviation is designed to improve safety standards. The aviation industry doesn't stand still regarding safety. So if something worries you, remember that the bottom line is that it's already been considered from a safety point of view. Air travel is surprisingly cheap, bearing in mind the enormous cost of aircraft in terms of design, maintenance, and the cost of operating it in a strictly controlled safety environment. Say to yourself, why would they do this if it wasn't safe? Remember, always challenge your beliefs by asking the question, where is the evidence for my thoughts? To finish this section, I'm going to describe the movements and noises on an aeroplane when it's flying, because it's about time we started talking about planes. So, this is the briefest of introductions to aircraft. An aeroplane is designed to cruise at high altitude where the engine and wings are most efficient. When the aircraft is climbing, descending, manoeuvring, and changing height or speed, the pilots will need to adjust the amount of power from the engines. The pilot will also need to change the shape of the wing as the aircraft slows down and speeds up. This is done by increasing or reducing the size of the wings with the flaps, which come out at the front and back of the main wings. The flaps will cause the aircraft to slow down, but it will also allow the aircraft to fly more safely at a lower speed, which is obviously an advantage for taking off or landing. But it does mean that more engine power is required. As the flaps extend more and more, then the increase in engine power will become greater until the aeroplane begins to descend again, when less power is required. As your plane gathers speed after takeoff, the flaps are reduced because the wings get extra lift from the extra speed. This means that during the departure, but more so during the arrival, there will be lots of changes to the aeroplane. When the wheels are lowered, it slows the plane down, so more power is required to maintain the speed. All these movements and sounds are upsetting to a nervous passenger, especially when there may be turbulence around as well. But remember the difference between the movement of the aeroplane caused by turbulence and those brought about by the actions of the pilot. Try to explain to yourself what is going on when the aircraft is manoeuvring during takeoff or landing. I'll talk about the takeoff at another time. For now, I'd like you to think about what I've just said about aircraft and apply some of the things that I've said previously about negative thoughts and maybe use one of those thought-stopping techniques. Part 6. Feelings and sensations that you get in a plane. When I first became a pilot, I was very interested in the medical side of aviation. In particular, I was interested in the physiological effects that flying had on the human body. Little did I know that at the end of my career and in this retirement, that interest would change direction from the effects of flying on pilots to the effects of flying on passengers. We've seen so far that the fear of flying is very much connected with thoughts and interpretations. We also know that ignorance and misinformation adds to the mystery and doubts about the safety of flying. I've already suggested ways of dealing with your thoughts, and this course will highlight many of the facts about flying that are of interest and value to you and other anxious flyers. This section is about the feelings that you get when flying, not the emotional ones, but the physical ones. Without some knowledge of what happens to us on an aeroplane, you will always wonder why we get those funny feelings when flying. First, we must recognise that the human body is built for travelling at about 4 miles an hour in the direction in which we're looking. Most of us can travel a little faster than this when we're running, and some athletes, of course, can travel very quickly. But even the speed of an Olympic champion is nothing compared with the speed of even the slowest aircraft. So how does speed affect us in what we feel? Speed itself, of course, doesn't matter because, after all, most of us on the planet Earth are travelling at least 1,000 miles an hour as the Earth spins, and even faster as we rotate around the Sun, and faster still as our galaxy spins in space. But, of course, the speed is steady, so we don't notice it. In an aeroplane, the speed changes. For example, during takeoff, it changes from nothing to 180 miles an hour. And then gradually during the climb, it speeds up to over 600 miles an hour. We only notice speed when and while it's changing. When the aeroplane speeds up for takeoff, your mind knows that the plane is level because we know that the runway is flat and straight. Therefore, when we're pushed back into our seats, we know that it's the result of going faster, just as we feel in a car. However, when we're in cloud and you can't see anything outside, there are two ways that we can be pushed back into our seats. First, by going faster, or secondly, when the pilot raises the nose to start a climb. Without being able to see outside the aeroplane, you can't tell the difference between those two manoeuvres. The only clue is the time that the engine noise changes, and even so, it would require someone very familiar with flying to notice the difference. In both circumstances, going faster or climbing, you feel that you're being pushed back into your seat. When the plane slows down, just like being in a car, you will have the feeling of being thrown forward. And you will get the same feeling in an aeroplane when the nose goes down during the descent. Once again, the only clue will be the engine power changing. But of course, an aeroplane doesn't just fly in straight lines, it has to turn corners. It has to level out when it's been climbing, and it has to level out when it's been descending. By levelling out, I mean staying at the same height. The position of the nose, and whether it's up or level or down, is unconnected with whether the plane is staying at the same height. In fact, you can be in an aeroplane where the nose is above the level position, and yet is going down. Let's see what happens to our bodies when the aeroplane is in a climb and then goes into level flight. During the climb, you're tipped back into your seat and your weight is taken both on your bottom and your back, depending upon the steepness of the climb. When the plane changes from climbing to being level, you will have a distinct impression of being tipped forward, because now your weight will come off your back. If the aeroplane slows down at the same time, you will once again be thrown forward slightly. There is no way that you can know whether you're being thrown forward because of levelling out, or changing speed, or even descending, if you have no instruments to tell you. If the aeroplane has been descending, you will be leaning forward slightly. As the aeroplane levels out, some of your weight will be transferred to your back, as it normally is when you're sitting. But if the aeroplane speeds up at the time it levels out, you will be pushed further back into your seat. And, as I said earlier, you won't know whether you're being pushed back in your seat because the aeroplane is speeding up or whether it's going into a climb. And in fact, on this occasion, it's just flying level. Perhaps I have exaggerated things slightly and an experienced traveller or pilot will know what is happening to the aeroplane because of the stage of flight and other clues. But to someone new to flying or anxious about flying, they'll find it very hard to interpret exactly what is happening. If you go into a room where a picture is hanging on the wall, you can see whether it's straight or not. Even the slightest tilt will be obvious. This is because other clues guide us to what is up and down, like the appearance of the walls, windows and doors. Another clue is gravity. Perhaps you didn't know this, but an aeroplane makes its own gravity when it's turning or levelling off. As a result, our ability to see if something is tilted or not is completely lost. You may believe that up is in a particular direction, but the chances are that you'll be wrong. The feeling of down for you while you're in a plane will always be towards the floor. If you drop something on a plane, it will always fall towards your feet, even if the aeroplane is banked and your feet aren't pointing towards the ground. When you're in a plane, you may believe that one thing is happening, but in fact another may be happening. And even if you can see out of the window, your balancing system will be influenced by the plane's gravity. Now, just in case you're a scientist or mathematician, it's not the plane's gravity. It's a force generated by the plane's movement. But the plane's gravity is an easy way of describing what happens. Having your body tell you one thing and your eyes another is very disorientating. This disorientation is something that pilots learn about very early in their careers. For an anxious passenger, it can be very, very unsettling. And of course, if you feel unsettled, you'll feel uneasy, and you'll interpret this as danger. Let's see now what happens to you when the aeroplane is turning, because this is both interesting and important. Those of you who can remember your school biology will recall that in our ears there are balancing mechanisms. They're like three spirit levels set at 90 degrees to each other. More simply explained, they can detect the following movements. Nodding, the movement that is involved with turning your head from side to side, and the movement of tilting your head from side to side. These detectors are tubes that have very sensitive hairs in them. The tubes contain fluid. As our heads move, so the fluid swishes one way or another, and the sensitive hairs tell our brain which way our head has moved. But, as I have said, the aeroplane makes its own gravity, so when a plane starts to turn, the fluid in the ears swish one way, and gradually they return to what they think is the level position because of the plane's gravity. And as I have said, the true level position will be different from the one that you are feeling. This means that you will not know whether the plane is in a turn or not unless you can see outside the aircraft. But of course, even then you may have a very restricted view. Perhaps all this sounds unnecessarily complicated, even though I've tried to make it as simple as possible. But it is an important thing for you to know about, and even if you can't remember everything I've said, at least you'll know that when you're feeling unbalanced or disorientated in a plane, there are very good reasons for it. And you can't do anything about it either. Now, if only it were as simple as that. Unfortunately, there's something else to consider, and that's an effect that's very similar to going up or down in a lift. As you know, when you get in a lift to go up, as it starts to move, you'll feel the floor pushing up against you, and this makes you feel slightly heavier than normal. And, as the lift slows down, you feel slightly lighter. The reason for feeling slightly lighter as the lift begins to slow is that you continue to go up while the lift is gradually slowing down. If you get the chance, take some bathroom scales into a lift and watch your weight change as the lift goes up and down. Very interesting, but what has this to do with aeroplanes? Well, when an aeroplane has been climbing and goes into level flight, it's like a lift slowing down after going up. You will feel as if you're leaving your seat slightly. Now, the extraordinary thing about this is that even though you're going up, after a few seconds, that feeling of lightness will make you feel as if you're going down. I suppose to prove this, I should encourage you to take a kitchen chair into a lift and tip it when it's going up and down, but I think you'll attract enough attention already with the bathroom scales. Maybe you should just take my word for it. A simple way of seeing how our bodies are confused by movement is this small experiment. If you have a car which is fitted with cruise control, find a road which, after a level stretch, goes uphill. Set the cruise control and close your eyes. As the car maintains speed while it goes up the hill, you will be convinced that the car is going faster. And similarly, after a steady speed, if the car goes down a hill, you will think that the car has slowed down. Perhaps I should have first said that you should get someone else to drive the car for you and that you should be the passenger. Anyway, it's all to do with which way you're tipping. I think that's nearly enough about the movements of an aeroplane and its effects upon your body. But before we go on to a new section, I'd like to mention a couple of other important physiological things that are in our control. It's about things that anxious flyers think help, but in fact do the opposite. Caffeine, and alcohol. Remember that the effects of caffeine and alcohol are greatly increased with the reduced air pressure in the cabin. Because of the air conditioning, the moisture content in the air of an aircraft is much lower than we're normally used to. You'll need to drink water to prevent dehydration. When you cross time zones of more than about 5 hours, you'll require at least a day to acclimatise to the local time. When you cross time zones, your sleep patterns will be severely disrupted. On long flights, meals will sometimes be served at times when your body is neither expecting or needing food. All these factors will take a toll on your well-being and your ability to resist stress. At these times, you'll need to use your relaxation, breathing, and visualization techniques to maintain a positive frame of mind. Most importantly, I suppose, all these effects are very subtle, and you'll probably be inclined to put them down as general tiredness. However, stay aware of these important physiological symptoms. Remember that a fit mind and a fit body will help you to use all your strategies more effectively and enable you to face your fear.